Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Boston and became the special counsel to President Nixon. He was known in the White House as the Hatchet Man and went to prison for obstruction of justice. While in prison, he met Christ and founded Prison Fellowship Ministries, which today has 100,000 volunteers in 112 countries. He's the author of 22 books and is heard daily on over 1,000 radio stations. His name, Chuck Colson. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760, WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Chuck Colson, the founder of Prison Fellowship Ministries. Chuck, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Well, Jack, it's nice to be with you. I've been with you before and always enjoyed it.
Can we start by you talking about your childhood and your
sure.
parents?
I grew up in the typical, I guess, middle-class depression family in America. My dad working for 30 bucks a week and bread lines all around us and everybody working hard. My dad was also going to law school at night, so I got really instilled with the work ethic when I was a kid. Nobody in my family had gone to college. My dad had done it at nights. And I earned a scholarship to Brown University. And this was at a time between World War II and the Korean War. I went through on a Naval ROTC scholarship, took my commission in the Marines. But I had the American success story coming from pretty humble beginnings and in a lean time in America and ending up with an honors graduate from an Ivy League college and then in the Marines.
What did you learn from your mom and your dad?
Well, I learned to work hard, that's for sure, because you had to in those days to survive. I also learned how important it was to be frugal and to not spend more money than you had, because I saw so many people starving in the Depression years. That left an indelible impression on me. My dad used to teach me some wonderful lessons. He was my closest friend, as well as being my father. I'd sit down on the back porch of our house, which was just outside of Boston, on a Sunday afternoon, and I had maybe 3 or 4 hours a week with him because he was working and going to school. And he would always say to me, Chuck, whatever you do, don't lie. Just always tell the truth. And he said, and whatever you work at it as hard as you can possibly work at it. He said, even if it's cleaning toilets, do the best job you know how. Well, this was the Puritan work ethic that was instilled in me as a kid. And it's interesting because later when I was in the Marines and I was an officer of the day at the barracks for the battalion, The inspecting officer came through and he found the toilets dirty. And he did something that was demeaning to a lieutenant. He turned to me and said, Lieutenant, you're the officer of the day. Clean them. Oh, I ended up cleaning toilets. Did a good job because I remember the lesson my dad had taught me. And then in Watergate, the great scandal that I lived through, I was charged by the prosecutors of all kinds of things, but never perjury because my dad had made it so clear to me, just always tell the truth, you won't get in trouble. That I told the truth, and that was the one thing they never charged me with. I was the only person in Watergate that didn't get charged with perjury.
At age 38, you become special counsel to President Nixon. What did you do, and how did you get that job at age 38?
Well, it was the continued success story, because when I got out of the Marine Corps, I came to Washington, went through law school nights, earned a degree with all kinds of honors. Did just what my dad had done. I was working in the Navy Department. I got picked up by a senator who met me and was impressed. And by the time I was 26, I was administrative assistant to a United States senator, the youngest in the Senate at the time. I left that in 1960, began to practice law. I got a very successful law practice. I had known Richard Nixon when he was vice president, and then I worked with him a little bit in the early 60s. He was a man I admired enormously. And come 1968, when he was running for president, he asked me to join his campaign, which I did, and then I went back to my law firm, and then he asked me to come and be his assistant in the White House, which I, at age 38, did.
What did you do every day?
Oh, my goodness, Jack. I had a wide-ranging portfolio. The president would deal with me on a lot of the communication strategies of the administration. I dealt with all the special interest groups that came to us. I dealt with most of the major political questions. But he would just as easily call me in and talk about should we cease bombing in North Vietnam, or he might call me in and talk about how he wanted to reorganize some government agency. I was kind of his jack of all trades for 3.5 years.
Ultimately, you went to prison. What did you do wrong?
Well, the whole White House collapsed over one stupid, idiotic mistake. I still say I don't know how or why they did it, which was to break into the Democratic National headquarters and wiretap the phones. I mean, there was nothing you were ever going to find out there. I found out about it after the break-in was after the thing was exposed, and they went back in a second time, got caught, and that was Watergate. And I thought, I told the president, it's on the tapes. I said, that's the stupidest thing anybody ever did. You're not going to get any information out of the Democratic National Committee. Well, that led to one thing and another, and then the president tried to protect John Mitchell, who apparently is attorney general and closest personal friend, who was involved, and a cover-up began. And many months later, it became obvious that we had not told the truth. People had perjured themselves before grand juries, and there was a conspiracy which resulted in eventually 25 people going to prison. I was one of those. I was brought in kind of on the fringes of it, actually. What I pled guilty to was disseminating derogatory information in the newspapers about Daniel Ellsberg. He was the fellow, you may remember that name, who stole the Pentagon Papers and exposed them in the early 70s. And that was viewed by all of us at the time as a great threat to national security. So we went after him. And one of the things I did was to put out defamatory information from FBI files to the press. And that's interfering with a guy's right to a fair trial. So for that, I pled guilty and got a 1 to 3 year sentence in prison.
Chuck, it's very hard for most of us to admit that we did wrong and to say I'm sorry. Why is that, and what advice would you give to us about that?
Well, the reason people can't do it, and it was hard for me too, is the fact that our pride gets in the way, number one. Number two, all human beings have an infinite capacity for self-rationalization. I can do things, and I can later say, well, they were wrong, but I had a good reason for doing it, or everybody does it. There's 100 excuses. The devil made me do it, Flip Wilson. People never want to take responsibility for their own shortcomings and their own failures and their own sins. So we excuse it or we try to justify it, and our pride is what gets in the way. It was my pride that I realized, Jack, that was driving me all these years. I thought I'd been idealistic. I wanted to serve my country. I gave up a lucrative law practice to go into the White House. And I thought I was just doing my duty, and I was, in part. But I was also proud. I wanted to be the best at everything I ever did, very competitive. And so a lot of it was my pride. And that's what, after when the Watergate scandal broke and I was out of the White House and found myself in the crosshairs of the prosecutors, it was a friend who witnessed to me about what Jesus Christ had come to mean in his life and how his life had been transformed, that I really confronted my deepest sin, and the deepest sin is pride, and that's what makes it really hard to say, I was wrong, please forgive me. But once you've said that to Jesus and you have your slate wiped clear, there's a tremendous freedom that comes to human beings when that happens.
We're talking to Chuck Colson, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Chuck Colson. One day, Chuck, six of you sit in a circle, three ex-convicts and three who, quote-unquote, hadn't been caught, and you start a ministry. Can you talk about that?
Sure. When I got out of prison, I've said to many people in interviews, including Mike Wallace, and last year when Dan Rather went off the air, I was one of his closing interviews. And I said on all those occasions, thank God for Watergate, because as a result of Watergate, I went to prison. I spent 7 months there. I saw the utter futility of the prison system. I realized as a Christian, I'd been there for a purpose, and I'd better do something about it. And so although I really didn't want to go into ministry, that was about the last thing I wanted to do, I decided that's really what God had allowed me to go to prison for. And so I got together a little group of guys. We took some of the royalty checks from my first book, Born Again, which was published in 1976, 30 years ago, and we started the ministry, and that was exactly 30 years ago. And our dream was to disciple men and women in prison the way I had seen people discipled when I was a prisoner, and then put them back in prison and let them work with the other inmates. And we started that. It was started on a very modest basis, and it's now spread, as you know, Jack, because you've seen some of it around the world, now spread to 113 countries around the world, and virtually every prison in America. It's become God has done a wonderful work. It's become a great outreach to hurting and suffering people.
It's grown to 112 countries and 100,000 volunteers worldwide. How did that ever happen?
Well, it couldn't be explained in human terms because I never figured it out and I never strategized. I didn't plan to do this. The thing I was most concerned with was keeping a promise I'd made to the inmates I'd left behind in the prison in Maxwell Federal Prison Camp in Montgomery, Alabama. I said, I'll be back to help you. So I knew I had to do something to help the inmates, but I certainly didn't plan on starting a worldwide movement. I really think what's happened is the Spirit of God has touched people around the world, and they've seen a great need, and I probably made it more visible by my celebrity, and so people realize, gee, we've got to do something about the prisons, and what we've been doing isn't working. And maybe this is the answer to bring God into the prisons, and it certainly is. It has proven to be hugely successful. I guess success begets success because our work started to really make a difference in prisons, and wardens began to talk about it, and the chaplains began to ask us to come in and do more, and then we graduated. We started doing other things, like taking Christmas gifts to children at Christmas time who have parents in prison, and we would get their names and addresses from the inmates in the prison, and then we'd visit them, bring them gifts, tell them what Christmas is all about, the birth of Jesus, not about tinsel and toys. And since that started, Jack, which was in 1982, we have gotten to 7.5 million kids with gifts and with a gospel message and with some help. And we've sent 10,000 to camp. Rich and Helen DeVos, who live in Michigan, within range of this program, have funded scholarships for those kids every summer, and the 10,000 last summer went to camp. It's a wonderful, wonderful program, and looks like even more will be going this year. The numbers are very encouraging. So it's had a tremendous effect, but it really has not been as a result of any planned strategy. It's been movement of people who catch on to the vision, and we go out and do it.
You've spent thousands of hours with prisoners all over the world. What have the prisoners taught you?
Oh, I've learned so much from them. I learned a great deal when I was in prison. I discovered that the people there are just like I am. I wasn't any better than they were. They'd gotten caught doing something wrong, and many of them serious offenses. I don't mean to minimize that. But a lot of them were just like neighbors off the street. I mean, you wouldn't think that, you can't tell a criminal by how he looks. What happens in the human heart isn't always displayed in the face or behavior of the person, and you discover that there's just tons of these people who got themselves in trouble, got in with the wrong people, made a serious mistake, didn't know what to do about it, and a lot of them have very little help or hope when they're in prison. I also learned that there's a lot of gifted people that end up in prison. And if they get a decent break, can make something of their lives. And I've discovered, probably more than any other single thing that I've learned in my entire life, if you invest yourselves in some of these people that the rest of society has written off, they can turn out to be the most influential and powerful people. They can do things I suppose because it's so paradoxical, you don't expect it of them. But we've got people outside, we've got people that we worked with in prison who are now outside ministering churches. One's the chaplain in the prison that he was in as an inmate, 2,000 inmates. He's now the chaplain for them. He went through a Wheaton College with a scholarship, Chuck Colson scholarship. There are some really powerful people. Matter of fact, Mark Early, who's the president of the Ministry of Prison Fellowship, he runs things now. Mark Early says that the next wave of leaders coming to the church is going to come out of the prisons. It has in other generations, and we see real signs of this.
We're talking to Chuck Colson, the author of 22 books, including his own autobiography, Born Again. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Chuck Colson. Chuck, we have 10 million people in Michigan and 52,000 in our prisons. 300 million in America, 2.2 million in prison. In Japan, they have 150 million people and only 82,000 in prison. Why do we have so many people in America in our prisons?
Well, obviously, Jack, we have made not the best use of prisons. We put everybody in prison in this country. We have the highest incarceration rate per capita of any country on earth in recorded figures. If you look at a lot of the figures that aren't published, I think China probably outdoes us. And for a while, the Soviet Union, when it was the Soviet Union, outdid us. Otherwise, we're number one in the world. And when I got out of prison, Jack, just to give you an idea of how fast this has happened, when I got out of prison, which was 30 years ago, there were 229,000 people in prison. Today, as you just noted, it's 2.2 million. So that's a tenfold increase in 30 years. And what we are discovering is that the number of people who get out every year is going up just as fast, obviously, about 600,000 a year now, which is three times the size of the United States Marine Corps that I served in. And 66% are going to be recidivists. They're going to repeat it. They're going to be rearrested within 3 years. And those numbers are unchanged. So the more people we get in prison, the more people are coming out, committing crimes, and going back in. Now, part of the problem is we make too much. We put people in prison for too long. We put a lot of nonviolent people in prison who don't need to be there. We jam the prisons full. We turn them into pretty violent places. We don't have the resources to really provide programs to help inmates. So you're warehousing human beings. I saw that when I was in prison. I've seen it in the 600 prisons I've been in since. And you're not getting at the cause of crime. The cause of crime is not poverty or environment or race. The cause of crime is people making wrong moral choices. And warehouse somebody in a prison, you're not reforming his behavior. You're probably making it worse. So what we're going to have to do something about the criminal justice problem and the crime problem and the prison problem in America is start using some alternatives to prison, start using some work programs, bringing some rehabilitative programs into the prisons, which we're doing now in six or seven prisons across America, where we basically run that unit on a Christian basis, and see these men's lives and women's lives transformed. So it's going to take a major overhaul. It's something we've been preaching about, demonstrating, and it's got to happen, however, because it's getting too expensive. It's ridiculous. The cost of the prison system in many states is more than the cost of educating kids. That's shocking.
We're talking to Chuck Colson, who hosts a nationally syndicated radio show heard daily on 1,000 stations. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back with Chuck Colson, who was the special counsel to President Nixon from 69 to 73. It's 1983, Chuck, and you established Justice Fellowship which is now the largest faith-based criminal justice reform group. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that started because I was almost in a prison riot out in the state of Washington, in Walla Walla. I went in the prison after the inmates had been locked down for something like 6 months. There'd been a killing of a guard, and there was a lot of violence in the place. It was just awful. I met the assistant warden at the front gate. I said, "What's it like inside?" He said, "I don't know. I'm not able to walk in. It's not safe for me to walk in there. Glad you arrived." And I'm thinking, "Oh my, this was bad scheduling." But out of that, I started working with the inmates inside, and they trusted me. And then I went to the state capitol and testified about the conditions in the prison, which were deplorable. Spoke to both the Republican and Democratic caucuses. And then eventually we got a settlement. We got it worked out. We got some improvements in the prison. Of course, the inmates were grateful, and so was the administration. So that convinced us that you can't go into these prisons, which many of which are just cesspools, without caring about the condition in the system itself. And so it'd be like my going into Louisiana after Katrina and paying no attention to the flood. I mean, you can preach about Jesus, but you better be mindful of what the people there are going through. So we started a small group called Justice Fellowship, which is to advance biblical concepts of justice in society and particularly in the prison systems. It's headed today by a man by the name of Pat Nolan, who is a tremendous guy. He's the former a Republican leader of the California Assembly who got into a sting and went to prison, was 27 months in prison, has had a tremendous experience with the Lord, and is now going around the country advocating what we call restorative justice. I've written a book about it, Justice That Restores. And it's some really good concepts. We've worked with President Bush on a number of things that are going on in Washington, including a prison rape commission, which is to try to do something about prison rape. And also reentry programs. The president has taken a great interest, because of our work largely, in prisoner reentry, making grants available to faith-based groups to help people when they get out of prison get readjusted. I've been working, Jack, in 30 years in the prison. I have to tell you, we've put 90% of our resources in corrections into what you do to stop crime and by getting people locked up. Then we do nothing about what happens at the other end. But the other end is where all the danger is. And we've got to be spending more time in our ministry. We've got to be spending more time in the prison system dealing with how you get inmates back out and readjusted into the community. You've got something really good going on in Detroit called Transition to Prisoners. And it's a reentry program that Joe Williams used to be part of Prison Fellowship. We spun it off so it could take state funds. But Joe Williams is a great guy, and it's really good work going on right in Detroit. And it's the kind of thing that has to go on all across the country.
A few years ago, I asked you to write your philosophy of life for me, which you graciously did. And this is the last paragraph. Quote, "Jesus told his disciples, 'He who seeks to save his life will lose it. He who loses his life for my sake will find it.' That perhaps captures my philosophy better than anything else." Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think the whole key of life is learning how to subordinate yourself, how to serve others, how to, in the sense, lose your life. Instead of trying to grab everything for yourself, serve others. And you start out by serving God first, which is serving Christ, and then serving the least of these. I'm 74 years old now. I've just written about this in a book called The Good Life. And I'm 74, and you kind of think about your life and what it's accomplished and what things you want to get finished before you're finished. And when you look back on your life, what matters, I've gotten all kinds of honorary doctorates and awards, and I won the Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion, go to Buckingham Palace. I mean, all this stuff is great. But it doesn't mean a hoot when you get to the end. Get near the end of your life, what matters is, did you keep your word and take care of the people around you? Did you help others? And I say that what I want to be remembered by and for are not buildings and monuments and all these achievements and big organizations. I'd like to be known by the living monuments of my life, who are the individuals who were broken, lost, forgotten, locked away in prison. Nobody cared about them. They've been transformed by the power of Christ, and now they're working for God and their fellow man on the outside. I look at those people, and I get thrilled every day when I I learned of more of them around. People stopped me on the street. I was in Costco with a few months ago, and a fellow came up to me, broke down in tears, and said, "You helped my daughter while I was in prison." And, I mean, those are the kind of things that they warm your heart when you get to the end of the course.
You've stated many times that Alexander Solzhenitsyn is one of your greatest heroes.
Yes, he is.
Why?
Well, because he learned this lesson the hard way. He was in prison. First of all, a man of enormous courage. He was the Soviet dissident who broke with the Soviets. Stalin put him in prison in the Gulag for 10 years. Didn't break him, didn't destroy him. He went through cancer surgery, almost died in the prison. And yet he wrote some of the greatest books of the 20th century, exposing the horrors of the Soviet gulags. So he's a man of enormous courage. He's a man of enormous intellect, because he was a great, great writer, won the Nobel Peace Prize, has been warning us in the West that we're decadent, that the problem is the breakdown of moral values in American life. He's a great prophetic spokesman for the world we live in. And he wrote in prison, and it stuck with me because it's such a formula for life. He wrote in prison, he wrote this from while he was in prison, and it appears in Gulag Archipelago, number 2, his second volume. He said, "Bless you, prison, bless you for being in my life, for there, lying on the rotting prison straw, I came to realize that the object of life is not prosperity, as we are made to believe, but the maturing of the human soul." Now, that's a guy who understands that you lose your life for Christ's sake in order to find it. If you seek to save your life, you're going to lose it. He figured that out in prison, and it's a profound statement.
C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, had a dramatic effect on your life. One chapter in the book is about the great vice, pride.
Yeah, this is what we were talking about in one of the earlier segments on this broadcast. The thing that makes us not want to say, "I did it, I'm wrong, I'm sorry," is pride. We're too proud to admit that. And I was a very proud guy. I was a platoon commander and went out of the Marines as a captain into the reserves. And I was gung-ho, and I was good at what I did, and I was the youngest administrative assistant in the Senate. I was one proud guy, and I realized that had been driving me all my life. And when I finally confronted in a friend's home one hot evening in the summer of 1973, confronted the claims of Christ that my friend told me about his experience with Jesus. And then he gave me this book. He read to me, actually, from one chapter out of Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, called The Great Sin, Pride. Proud men are always walking through life looking down upon other people and other things. They cannot see something above themselves, immeasurably superior, God. And while I was reading this, while it was being read to me, it was just like a torpedo hit amidships. I mean, I was staggered because I figured, Lewis has figured me out. This is exactly who I am. And that night in the driveway, in a flood of tears, I gave my life to Christ. And that's 33 years ago, and nothing's been the same since. Nothing can ever be the same again, Jack.
We're talking to Chuck Colson, who donates all of his speaking engagements and book royalties to Prison Fellowship Ministries. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Chuck Colson. Chuck, for most of us, God is the spare tire in our life. When something goes wrong, we jump in that trunk, we get that spare tire, we promise him anything, I'll change my life, help me out. For a few, he's the steering wheel of our life. What advice would you give us to become more of a steering wheel, not a spare tire?
Well, first of all, the most critical question anybody ever has to ask in life is, where did I come from? And this has been asked by everybody going back to the ancient Greeks and to the civilizations before that, prehistoric times. Everybody wants to know, where did I come from? Why am I here? And the critical question in modern American life is, did I come out of the primordial soup? Was I the result of some single-cell life form that grew billions of years ago and mutated and chance mutations all these years later, and here I am, a grown-up germ? Or was I created by God? Is the Bible right? Is the Christian religion correct? Is it possible that I really was made by a loving God in His image? You got to answer that question. The only third option is that you're nothing but a dream in the mind of God, or it's the Matrix movie, we're not real. But either you came from God or you came from nature, one or the other. And I think 90% of the American people say they believe in God. That means they reject the notion that they're nothing but grown-up germs coming out of the primordial soup, because that's something that as a human being you can't believe, because you have a conscience, you have a sense of love, you have consciousness, you're aware of your mortality, you have a sense of purpose. These things don't come out of inanimate objects. So I think we know internally there's a God. The imago Dei, the image of God, is in us. Most of the time we're running away from Him. And the reason we're running away from Him is that we think He's going to make life more difficult for us. He's going to put some moral limitations on us. I used to believe in God in a general fashion. Growing up in America, you're not Jewish. What are you? You go to church once in a great while. My family took me once in a great while. But if anybody had asked me to get serious about God, I'd have been very nervous about it until my own crisis in my life. And the reason is he makes certain demands on us. What we don't realize until we get to that point is that they really aren't demands. They're really an invitation to a much better way to live your life. And I look back now and realize I was in bondage before to sin, and now I'm free. And it's just the reverse of what people think. So what would I say to somebody? Don't be like so many people that I run into in jail or foxhole religion. You grab God when you need Him. If you really believe He's there when you need Him, you better pay attention to Him when you don't need Him, because He's not going to pay attention to people who don't pay attention to Him. And it doesn't make sense to live your life contrary to your basic belief. And if God created us, then you better start paying attention to God. And you, out of thankfulness and gratefulness to God for what He does for you in life, be willing to serve Him and worship Him and go to church and be part of the community of believers. Half of Americans are in church at least once a month. I mean, it's amazing. Half this country. And now a lot of them just sit there. But I'd say to anybody who's listening to me, the most important moment in my life is when I got serious with God, when I really turned to Him and said, I want to know You. I want to surrender my life to You. I want to give You my life. I want to know Jesus. I want Jesus in my life. Forgive me my sins. When I did that, the last 33 years have been, even the worst days, I mean, going to prison and cancer surgery and all the things I've been through in my life and two kids with cancer, the worst days of the last 33 years are better than the greatest days of the years that went before. Don't miss it. It makes sense out of life. I don't know how you could live without it.
In 1998, you gave a commencement speech at Geneva College entitled, Does Character Matter? Chuck, what's character? And does character really matter?
Well, character is our nature. It is who and what we are. In other words, what's our character? Is it good or is it bad? Good character is one of the trophies of life. If you can live your life with integrity, wholeness is a word for really what integrity means. You're the same in private that you are in public. You're consistent in your commitments to a virtuous life, then you have character, good character. Then you are a person who can be trusted and depended upon. And I think if you're hiring somebody, and as we hire people in our ministry, or if you're trying to decide who you want to spend time with, the first characteristic you want to look for is not how smart they are, but how honest they are. What kind of character does that person have? And that, in the final analysis, will tell you whether you can trust your life on that person. I'll tell you, having been in the Marines, I learned a lot of lessons about this, because the guy next to you, your life is depending on him, and he's depending on you. And you better be sure that guy has got character. He's got guts. He's going to stand up and do the right thing at the right time. Otherwise, you're in trouble. So, and I've certainly learned that in the Christian life. When you love Jesus and want to give your life to Him, you want to be virtuous, not because it's some onerous moral command, but because it's a joy to live a life pleasing to God. And so you really, what you thought was the pleasure of sin becomes no pleasure at all. What really is pleasurable about life is to live what the Greeks called happiness. Greeks had a wonderful word for the happiness. It was eudaimonia. They considered you a happy, but eudaimonia, when you really look at the meaning of that word, is virtuous. And when our founders said in the beginning of this nation, in the Declaration of Independence, the celebration of which, the 230th celebration we just experienced, when they said that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, among these, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the actual word they were drawing on was eudaimonia, virtue. Virtue, you discover, which is the essence of living a life of good character and honor, is the highest quality, and it's the greatest joy.
A number of our guests on this show this past year have said that the best thing that ever happened to them was arguably the worst thing that ever happened to them. A murder of a loved one, an accident that maimed them for life, yourself going to prison. How do you explain that?
Well, this is what I wrote about in The Good Life, Jack. The life is filled with paradoxes. I mean, the gospel's a paradox. Jesus was crucified on the cross, the most hideous death the person could die, the most painful, excruciating, the word excruciating comes from the cross, for our sins, and paid a tremendous price. But out of that has come the greatest spiritual movement in human history. So the symbol of ugliness, of defeat at the hands of the Romans, becomes the symbol of God's victory, the cross. Now, that's a paradox. Paradox is that you cannot live the good life until you realize you're a sinner first. But lose your life for Christ's sake in order to find your life is a paradox. And the other paradox is, out of the greatest suffering always comes the greatest blessings. A friend of mine said he never would hire anybody who hadn't been broken in his life. It's a pretty good adage, because until a person's been broken, you don't know what that person's made of. And if the person is broken and he's finished, then he wasn't worth much. If the person was broken, went through a terrible experience, and overcame it, he's now a far stronger person. I look at prison as the best thing that ever happened to me, because it brought me in touch with other people that I otherwise ignored. It made me realize who I really was. It gave me a burden for people who need help. And now the great joy of seeing thousands, maybe millions, of people who have been helped because of my prison experience. I read a devotional every day called Streams in the Desert, which is a wonderful devotional. One of the lines in it, because it takes this theme throughout, is that suffering is the school of faith. And I think in all the great classic Christian traditions, that's a doctrine that is well understood. And we seek to share in the sufferings of Christ, as the Apostle Paul said.
We have 30 seconds. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Oh, my. Well, you're going to have to find your own way and make your own mistakes. I didn't listen to people when I was young, and I wish I had. But you won't. You'll have to bang your head a few times. But you got to ask yourself some critical questions. What's really important to me in life? Set your priorities early. Keep those priorities focused on God and your family and your honor and your commitment. And enjoy work, because if it's done under the glory of God, it's a good thing. And don't make the mistake I did of thinking you're in charge of your own life, because one day it'll crash in flames. Start turning to God early.
Chuck, thanks for being a teacher to millions of us these past 30 years.
Well, I thank you, Jack, and I wish you the best with your program. I love being on with you and appreciate you.
Our guest next Sunday will be Nick Vujicic, a 23-year-old Australian who was born with no limbs. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn.